Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, part two of a classic talk by Michael Parenti, Conspiracy and Class Power. I hope you'll stay tuned. Every so often, New World Notes plays a classic talk by political scientist Michael Parenti. Last week and this week, it's Conspiracy and Class Power. Parenti gave this talk in 1993 in Berkeley, California. That's 21 years ago, and I think all the events between then and now have confirmed the correctness and brilliance of Parenti's analysis. This was years before 9/11, but back then, too, researchers who found evidence of concerted illegal actions by powerful elites were immediately and automatically denounced by the corporate media and by some progressives as conspiracy theorists, which is a synonym of nutcase. But Parenti shows that there is a class system in the U.S., that class interests are in conflict, that the elite class is well aware of its own class interests, that the elites protect their interests mainly by fairly above board and, alas, perfectly legal methods through their control of the entire political system. But on occasion, when it serves their interests, the elite class is quite willing to engage in illegal secret conspiracies to get the results they desire. History provides a zillion examples. Picking up where we left off last week, here is Michael Parenti with part two of Conspiracy and Class Power.
In the mid-1970s, we had a very interesting development. Business leaders showed an increasingly class-conscious concern for the drift of things in the mid-70s. One corporate leader spoke to his concurring colleagues at a meeting of the conference board in 1974. I quote him, "The have-nots are gaining steadily. The have-nots are gaining steadily more political power to distribute the wealth downward. The masses have turned to a larger government." This isn't Lenin talking. This is a corporate elite. Unquote. Another top executive concurred. He said, quote, "If we don't take action now, we will see our own demise. We will evolve into another social democracy," meaning like Sweden and Denmark or something like that. Quite conscious and explicit awareness of their class interests. When they talk to each other, it's remarkable what they say. What they wanted was outlined, by the way, very explicitly. A cutback in government spending, massive cutbacks, government spending and human services. They wanted an increase in military spending. They wanted generous tax write-offs and credits for upper-income individuals and corporations. And they wanted a rollback of government regulations on business. That's what they wanted. Giant corporations like Citibank, IBM, Morgan Guaranty Trust, Exxon, Ford, and General Motors played an increasingly active and conscious role in financing conservative think tanks like the Hoover Institute, American Enterprise Institute, and seeing that a conservative business agenda got penetrated the academic circles and mass media. You saw in the 70s a mass array, an array of conservative pundits and columnists moving into the media, and they still clutter up that media today. Corporate money financed the campaigns of ideologically conservative candidates through political action committees, and the corporations devoted much more systematic effort to breaking labor unions. By 1978, some of the changes that corporate America wanted were already being instituted by the president himself, a Democrat named Jimmy Carter. He started cuts in human services. He started increasing military spending. Carter gave us Reaganism before Reagan. What corporate America wanted was an unencumbered ideological conservative, and their support went overwhelmingly to Ronald Reagan. They were trying to shift the center of political gravity of the entire policy arena in order to maintain class rule. and avoid a social democracy that might cut too deeply into their privileges, wealth, and class power. And they succeeded quite well. It's recognized that revolutionaries are capable of conspiracy. There are even laws against them. That revolutionaries are capable of concerted action directed toward consciously desired goals, but not counter-revolutionaries. Peace advocates, but not militarists and interventionists. Proponents of change, but not champions of the status quo. The poor, but not the rich. These ruling elites are as fervently involved in class struggle as any communist. And if they don't always succeed, they succeed often enough. They may not be omnipotent, but they're enormously powerful. They're far from infallible, but they have such a plentitude of resources as to do sufficient damage control and minimize their losses when mistakes are made, unlike us sometimes. The essence of political analysis is to try to define and divine intent. That's what you have to be looking at. And yet there's so many exposés that are written that never even deal with it. We read about environmental devastation. We read about the terrible effects of U.S. intervention in Panama or Nicaragua or Cuba or here or there. But why? Why is U.S. policy doing this? Why are they doing these things? We read about costly military bases. There's a very interesting book on that, The Sun Never Sets, how the U.S. has these globe bases all over the world. Why do they have this? Not mentioned. They talk about the costliness of it, the violation of the sovereignty of the countries involved, this, that, the other thing. But why? Why do they find this necessary? What are the interests involved? So we have even writing on the left where people don't ask why. We learn not to ask why, because once you ask why, then you cross the line from a liberal complaint into a radical analysis. Sometimes the mainstream investigators will look at why unjust things happen, and they will even ask it. And they will come up with innocuous answers or no answers. The media, by the way, specialize in that. Let me give you the example of the best in the media, in the mainstream media, the best, Bill Moyers. A televised show of his, April 92, the best of a terrible lot. Moyers discussed the federal tax system. He pointed out the gross inequalities of the tax structure, how corporations evaded taxes by investing overseas, how U.S. investors in Puerto Rico and foreign investors in this country were exempt from paying taxes on most of their earnings, how the tax structure was riddled with tailor-made exemptions that favored particular firms and big campaign contributions. I was listening, I was saying, wow, this is terrific. He was just laying these out one after the other with some footage and stuff and all that. And then Moyers cuts back to him and he turns to his panel of, quote, experts, and he asks, isn't this just a case of good intentions gone awry? And I said, why? And then he and the panelists proceeded to talk about the economy. They began to talk about the deficit, the need for more investments, as if all the stuff he had just said hadn't ever been said. It was a kind of a remarkable thing to see how you can actually lay data right out in people's faces, but it's what Alvin Gulner called the tyranny of background assumptions, that you can ignore that stuff and then just go on with the other usual blather. Not one of them talked about how wealthy interests consciously use their influence to extract special treatment under the law. It's the same with U.S. foreign policy. We hear again and again, U.S. policy is so foolish, so stupid. Why did we go in there? It's so stupid. Why are we doing that? Just because you don't understand what they're doing doesn't mean they don't understand what they're doing. And never is it asked, what is the intent? Without understanding intent, indeed, U.S. policy remains an unsettling mystery, a puzzling thing to liberal critics. But such policy is really rational and quite successful. It consistently moves against any nation or social movement that tries to change the client-state relations of U.S. dominance and imperialism, that tries to use a greater portion of its natural resources, markets, and labor for self-development. Moves that would infringe upon the interests of rich investors. Now, if taken in the larger context, U.S. policy appears consistent and sensible and predictable and mostly successful. But most media analysts and academic analysts lack this larger context, even most alternative media analysts. Once we realize these things about U.S. policy, we move, as I say, from a liberal complaint about how rational the policy is to a radical analysis about the rational interests involved and how a particular policy coincides with similar U.S. policies all over the world for decades, supporting privileged interests against popular movements. There are two models of conflict you can go with when conflicts arise. One model of conflict says that conflicts occur because of miscommunication. That's what group facilitators and moderators specialize in. Now, that model certainly explains a variety of conflicts. It's a model that has validity, especially at the interpersonal level, I think. Model two says that conflicts occur, that some conflicts at least occur, not because of misunderstanding, but because both sides understand each other all too well. They understand what the other is up to, that at least one side has a conscious agenda that it wishes to impose in order to advance its own interests at the expense of the other. Labor management conflicts are not model one, they're model two. The workers get up and they say, we're being ripped off. And you always get some other commentator said, labor and management should really learn to work together as a team. This is occurring because of emotions and the hard feelings. They got it wrong. It's not the emotions and the hard feelings that are causing the conflict. It's the conflict that's causing the emotions and hard feelings. Well, how do we determine the intent? Walter Karp said, divining intent is the essence of political analysis. How do we decide that the reasons they give to justify their policies are true or false, regardless of whether they think them to be true? First, by the content of the issue itself. You know, when they give six different reasons, when someone starts giving you three, four different reasons and comes back and gives you a fifth reason why he did something, you can be sure that they're piling it on. Because if they did something and they know why they did it, and that's what they believe, that they would tell you that the first time. And what they're doing is they start grabbing for reasons. Every war we've gone into, there have been these reasons. Grab that. Rescue American students or civilians in the country. Stop them from doing this with the Russians because they were giving arms to so-and-so, because they were going to kill all the priests, whatever. So you can look at the consistency and inconsistency. You can look at the disparity between professed motives and actual behavior. Second, we can sometimes better judge intent by looking at the larger context, as I said before. Whole history of things that went on. When you look at the Gulf War, if you look at a whole history of imperialism, it takes on a new meaning, a new idea. And you could ask yourself such questions as, if Kuwait produced broccoli, would we be doing this or not? As the peace movement did. You see a repeated pattern. Generally, the news media reports are notoriously devoid of larger historical and political context. They almost never make a reference to a larger political or historical context. Except, of course, Soviet Union, Hitler-Stalin pact, a few things. They would occasionally go back to these anti-communist ones. Consider the following. I want to give you an instance. From 1984 through 1987, U.S. leaders and their faithful media commentators repeatedly charged that Nicaragua refused to agree to the Contadora plan to end hostilities in Central America. You remember Arias's Contadora plan. Now, that was a lie. That was a blatant, out-and-out lie. Nicaragua, in fact, had everything to gain from the Contadora plan and peace in the area. And they repeatedly announced they were willing to sign. And the U.S. at that time was prosecuting its war and embargo against Nicaragua with full force. U.S. officials unilaterally ended negotiations with the Nicaraguans and then blamed them for obstructing progress, despite, or really because of Nicaragua's willingness to reach a peace accord. U.S. intentions were revealed, this is what I mean by direct testimony, a National Security Council memorandum that was released under the Freedom of Information Act, August 30, 1984. No, not under the Freedom of it was released during the Iran-Contra hearings. Quote, we have trumped Nicaragua. We have effectively blocked Contadora group efforts to impose a second draft on the revised Contadora Act. So here they are boasting that they put a monkey wrench into the Contadora procedures. while publicly saying it's Nicaragua that has no interest, that's trying to undermine the Contadora. Another, weeks later, Admiral John Poindexter, memorandum, November 23, 1984, to National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane. Continue active negotiations, but agree on no treaty. What does that mean? Continue to negotiate, but absolutely no agreement. And agree to work out some way to support the Contras, that's the mercenary army, either directly or indirectly. And then here's a very interesting sentence, the most fascinating sentence I've seen in a government document in a long time. It said, withhold true objectives from staffs so that it's not leaked by anybody. See, withhold true objectives. Give your staffs the impression that you are working for an agreement under the Contadora plan, but withhold true objectives. And when a new pact, when the Contadora group produced a new pact, which all of them signed, Guatemala, El Salvador, Costa Rica, and Nicaragua, all of them signed in May 86, all of them agreed to sign, the New York Times reported that top U.S. officials convened a special meeting to deal with what one of them described as the peace scare. So you see, the truth comes out every so often. So that's not, this isn't a conspiracy fantasy. It's a conspiracy actuality to conclude that U.S. leaders were not interested in reaching a peaceful accord, that they were lying about their real intentions to the American public and even to their own staffs. Well, isn't this just a demonization of ruling elites? You have a demon theory about them the way they have about you. No, it's not demon theory. They see me and people like me as a real mortal enemy to their class interest. They're absolutely correct. It's not a kooky theory. They're right about me. I'm right about them. Are they really capable of supporting death squads, assassinations, tortures, violent deeds like this? You're talking about Yale, Princeton, Harvard graduates here. I remember speaking to a former CIA. He was in the administration at Yale University when I was back there for postdoctoral. And I remember him saying, well, Michael, it's not a pretty world out there. We have to sometimes do things that aren't very pretty because we're facing some very nasty individuals. We're compelled to do this. If the politics of the world were like politics in the U.S., we wouldn't have to do it. They're pretty dirty in the U.S. too. So they have it all rationalized. Yes, they are capable of such things. Even Congress, the last to know. I always think of Congress as the deceived spouse. They're always the last to know. Do you remember during the Iran-Contra hearings, the Republican senators who got up, Senator Cohn of Maine, Senator Rudman of Vermont, they got up and said, I thought we were intervening in Nicaragua because we were interdicting the arms that they were sending to El Salvador. Those guys really believed that reason. I said, boy, they're Boy Scouts. You read history. That stuff I've been doing on Spanish-American, well, same thing. These senators were getting up. They really believe the reasons that are given by the White House. At least they give every appearance of believing. But Congress eventually, some elements in Congress, catch on. A very unusual member of Congress, Robert Torricelli. Torricelli, head of the Torricelli bill against Cuba. Yeah, you can hiss, but on this issue, somehow, you see, Torricelli sponsors that bill because he actually thinks that Cuba is a bad place and a danger and we've got to democratize it. He really thinks that's what it is. So then he finds out what the U.S. was doing in El Salvador. And he says, Washington Post, March 17, 93, the chairman of a House subcommittee, Robert Torricelli, Democrat of New Jersey, charged yesterday that the Reagan administration lied to Congress for years about the Salvadoran armed forces' complicity in murder. And he said, quote, every word uttered by every Reagan administration official about the observances of human rights in El Salvador should be reviewed for perjury. Torricelli went on, It is now abundantly clear that Ronald Reagan made these certifications about human rights in defiance of the truth. Welcome to reality, Congressman. I just finished doing an investigation of the death of an American president. He died in 1850, Zachary Taylor. I wrote an article called History as Mystery, The Strange Death of President Zachary Taylor. In 1991, his tomb was opened, and they investigated it because one historian was suspicious that he had actually been poisoned. And they came out with a report that he wasn't poisoned, he died of natural causes. Well, I got the reports and started looking at them more closely and found all sorts of funny things. That the arsenic level in him was 15 times higher than the normal level in a person walking around, and a bunch of other things. And so I wrote this whole article. And one of the quotes I came across was by a historian, Eugene Genovese. He was asked by the press, would any political protagonist in the United States of 1850 be capable of such a deed? Taylor, you see, was opposing the slave power. He refused to have any extension of slavery. He was holding a hard line against any extension of slavery into the Western territories. And there was a lot of hard feeling against him about this. And when he died, Millard Fillmore came in and the policy immediately shifted. Total change in policy. The Compromise of 1850 came in. The slave powers got all they want. Fugitive slave laws were strengthened, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I won't go into any more particulars. But that's what it was about. There was a real political interest involved. And Genovese says, I can't imagine any Southern personalities who would have been involved in such a conspiracy. You know, it's an interesting thing when you make these kind of statements because it's a reflection of you. It's a reflection of how moderate and decent you are when you say, I can't imagine this kind of crazy thing happening. If you can imagine this kind of crazy thing happening, this sort of begins to raise some question about your credibility, you see. He goes on, he says, but there's always the possibility that there were some nuts who had access to him and did it. Well, I want to say that history shows us that nuts are not the only ones capable of evil deeds. That gentlemen of principle and power, of genteel manner, can arrive at very grim decisions. If they commit crimes, it's not because they harbor murky and perverse impulses, but because they feel compelled to deal with the dangers that oppose to their way of life. This doesn't mean that they're motivated by purely financial reasons, although that's a very real consideration, I think. But they equate their vital interests with the well-being of their society and their nation. In this case, with the well-being of the cause of Southern rights. And far from being immoral or unscrupulous, they are individuals of principles that are so lofty as to elevate them above the restraints of ordinary morality. They don't act on sudden impulse. The feeling grows among them that something must be done, something that's best for all, that the situation is becoming intolerable. They move gradually toward the position. The change is gradual, and yet it's so compelling that when they arrive at their decision, they're no longer shocked by the extreme measures they're willing to employ. The execution of the unsavory deed is made all the easier by delegating its commission to lower-level operatives. Most of the evil in history is perpetrated not by lunatics or monsters or lone psychotics, but by persons of responsibility and commitment whose most unsettling aspect is the apparent normality of their deportment. It's like child molesters we're finding, saying there's danger in the stranger. It's not the stranger we find out are the child molesters and the abusers. It's not some guy who goes around like this with drool coming down like this. It's the, in many cases, upright, estimable gentleman of the community who no one could believe would do such a thing. I'm going to end it, wind it up right here. Applies to the debate that's going on right now about the JFK assassination conspiracy. That there are people who are saying that we shouldn't get hung up on conspiracies. We should be looking at the larger institutional forces. And what I am arguing is that those larger institutional forces are directed by conscious human agency. And those agencies use conspiracy or non-conspiracy. They use conspiratorial forces or non-conspiratorial forces. And that the conspiratorial forces are important. They're not rare exceptions. And that they are systemic in their nature. and in their output. There are those who said that 3/4 of the American people believe that John Kennedy was killed by a conspiracy. So what? 3/4 of the American people, Coburn's made this argument, Chomsky's made this argument to me, 3/4 of the American people believe in miracles, too. Well, that's a very facile argument. It's a confusion. They're confusing the gullibility about miracles with the public's refusal to be gullible about the story that the officials are handing down to them about how Kennedy was killed. It's quite different. So what I would say is... what I would say to our friends is that we ought not to patronize the public. We ought to educate ourselves about the actualities of that murder and about every other conspiracy that goes on. We should not dismiss these conspiracies as distractions from the bigger picture, but see how they are an essential part of the bigger picture. The concern with conspiracy and assassination is not a manifestation of Camelot yearnings. It's not a search for lost messiahs or father figures. It's not an immature, kooky idea. It is the angry realization that state power is used in gangster ways by gentlemen gangsters who defend imperialism and the national security state. Concern about these issues is not gullibility, it's not irrational yearnings for lost leaders, but it's an expression of public concern about the nature of our government. The expression of public concern about the nature of our government, the angry criticism, there's a name for that, and that is called democracy, and let's have more of it. Thank you very much.
A long and well-deserved round of applause for Michael Parenti's brilliant 1993 talk, Conspiracy and Class Power. Parenti is still alive, still contributing to our understanding of national affairs. But for me, the Parenti stuff that's absolutely the most fun to listen to are his extremely witty public lectures from the 1990s. For this one, many thanks to Mariah Gilardin, producer of the program TUC Radio. Gilardin has assembled a very nice archive of Parenti lectures at her show's website, tucradio.org. And if you're browsing the web, feel free to mosey over to our own website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, that's me, myself, and our apprentice grave robber, Igor. On behalf of the entire staff, this is Kenneth Doust. Thank you for listening. Illegitimae non carborundum. Please come back again next week. And remember, you are not alone. Ciao.